from the downtown Minneapolis studios of News Talk A30 WCCO, this is Minnesota's most trusted station for news.
29 degrees and partly cloudy skies at 6:59. I'm Sloan Martin, News Talk A30 WCCO. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, like all of us, following the situation in Washington, D.C. today.
I just want to take just a moment to assure Minnesotans that the situation here is calm and stable. I just was speaking in contact with Senate Majority Leader Gazelka, a man of honor, a friend, and the two of us are in absolute alignment that the sacredness of our democracy, the ability to disagree agreeably, is fundamental.
The governor also announcing some loosening of the state's COVID-19 restrictions today. Starting Monday, restaurants and bars can reopen for in-person service at 50% capacity, closing at 10 p.m. Other businesses like movie theaters and museums can reopen at 25%. We have a complete rundown on our website, WCCORadio.com. Members of Minnesota's congressional delegation weighing in throughout today with a mix of sadness, anger, and sternness responding to what's happened in D.C. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the growing number of lawmakers who are supporting impeachment, she added in a tweet, "It's a matter of preserving our republic and we need to fulfill our oath." During the evacuation, reporters overheard Congressman Dean Phillips shout, "This is because of you," apparently directed at Republican colleagues. He later said, "This has been brewing for 4 years." Republicans like Congressman Pete Stauber and Tom Emmer both condemned violence and said protesters need to respect law enforcement and law and order. Meanwhile, here, state troopers and police are keeping a watchful eye tonight.
St. Paul Police Department spokesman Steve Linders says officers are keeping an eye on the situation and are prepared for any potential unrest tonight.
Even though Washington, D.C. is 1,500 or 1,700 miles away, what happens there could impact what happens in St. Paul. So our officers are briefed on what's happening, and they keep their eyes open, and as usual, if they see something, they try to take care of it and make sure everybody's safe.
Linder says the SPPD actually has a special operations unit of officers who are specially trained to help facilitate free speech and keep people safe during demonstrations and protests. Laura Oakes, News Talk 830 WCCO.
WCCO News Time 701. I'm Sloan Martin. We'll return now to CBS News coverage.
I would like to discuss this.
He did not leave the Capitol today. He's returned to the Senate. He's preparing to resume the Senate's business. And this is all being done in defiance of this mob that broke into the Capitol building, according to leaders, top lawmakers here on Capitol Hill, vowing to resume the work that is prescribed Capitol to Congress in the U.S. Constitution, Stephen.
In the Constitution and also in the 1887 Electoral Count Act, which provides that if an objection is to be raised, it's to be made by a member of the House and co-signed by a member of the Senate. And that forces a two-hour debate where the joint session breaks down and the House and Senate respectively debate within their own chambers whether to approve the objection, which would prevent the electoral votes from that particular state from being counted. And that process was just beginning with the state of Arizona alphabetically at the top of the list when the proceedings were interrupted when the mob stormed and took over the Capitol. But one of the key things we're wondering tonight is whether the Republicans in the Senate, whose co-signatures are required for the debates to occur, whether they're going to maintain their objections. And the question was put to Ron Johnson, the Republican senator from Wisconsin. The question was, are you still planning to object to the results when things get going again? And Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, said, quote, "We're going to be talking to our colleagues in terms of what's all happening here. We've been discussing this. Obviously, in light of events, there's a little bit of a different attitude." Johnson was asked by a reporter if the Republicans feel any responsibility for what happened at the Capitol today, and Johnson said, no, absolutely not, none whatsoever. He was also asked if the president has any responsibility, and Ron Johnson said no. So that is the late word from Ron Johnson, the Republican senator from Wisconsin, who is suggesting that perhaps there's a different attitude now amongst the Republicans in the Senate as to whether they will, in fact, continue with their plan to co-sign these objections and force many more hours of debate in the House and Senate. It is, as I mentioned, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Washington, D.C. is now under a citywide curfew imposed by the mayor. The D.C. National Guard has been deployed to the Capitol to enforce that curfew and to restore order. It was many hours of chaos on Capitol Hill. And Steve Dorsey, you can describe some of what it is we saw today when not only some of the demonstrators got into the Senate chamber, but they were held just outside the House chamber by officials with their guns drawn.
Yeah, and we heard them from this position. We heard the echoes, the USA, USA of this group, this mob approaching, trying to breach the sealed off House chamber. At that moment, I stuck my head onto the hallway, and Capitol Police were going door to door at the galleries. This is where the folks sit in the balconies, members of the press and other guests, locking each door, preventing people from entering. They told me to go back inside, secure that door. And then all the meanwhile, our producer, stuck inside the House chamber, Zach Hudak, was taking photos of what were security teams, perhaps members of the Sergeant at Arms, with guns drawn, about four of them, standing in front of a barricade that they built, a makeshift barricade against the main entrance, the front door, the back door, if you will, where the members enter the chamber. And on the other side of them were protesters. And apparently included in that group was a woman who was shot and then later died from her injuries that she sustained in the U.S. Capitol. It was dramatic moments that led to the evacuation of all of the U.S. Capitol building, and then eventually police surrounded the Capitol complex and pushed out these rioters, these protests, quite a distance away from the building so lawmakers, staffers, and journalists could return.
We have the audio of that video that our reporter Zach Hudak took. Let's listen in. This is the chaos inside the House chamber as you can hear shots being fired there outside the chamber. The audio was heard inside, and there are members of the Sergeant-at-Arms team with their pistols drawn, pointed at the door that Steve Dorsey describes, the door in the center of the chamber where the president is seen walking in for the State of the Union address. There's a large piece of wooden furniture there to prevent some of these marauding demonstrators from coming into the chamber. It's a scene unlike anything we've seen in the modern era, and frankly, you'd have to go back to perhaps the 1800s, the 19th century, for a similar situation. The Senate is, as you hear, now coming to order. Vice President Pence is at the chair. Let's listen in.
I'd like to give a brief statement with the indulgence of the senators. Today was a dark day in the history of the United States Capitol. But thanks to the swift efforts of U.S. Capitol Police, federal, state, and local law enforcement, the violence was quelled. The Capitol is secured, and the people's work continues. We condemn the violence that took place here in the strongest possible terms. We grieve the loss of life in these hallowed halls, as well as the injuries suffered by those who defended our Capitol today. And we will always be grateful the men and women who stayed at their posts to defend this historic place. To those who wreaked havoc in our Capitol today, you did not win. Violence never wins. Freedom wins. And this is still the people's house. As we reconvene in this chamber, the world will again witness the resilience and strength of our democracy. For even in the wake of unprecedented violence and vandalism at this Capitol, the elected representatives of the people of the United States have assembled again on the very same day to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. So may God bless the lost, the injured, and the heroes forged on this day. May God bless all who serve here and those who protect this place. and may God bless the United States of America. Let's get back to work.
Very clearly pained Vice President Mike Pence from the President's chair presiding over the Senate. This is live coverage from CBS News.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
I ask unanimous consent the Majority Leader and the Democratic Leader be allowed to speak and that the time not count against 2 hours of debate in relation to the objection raised on the state of Arizona.
Is there objection?
Majority Leader Mitch McConnell now intends to address the Senate.
So ordered.
I want to say to the American people, the United States Senate will not be intimidated. We will not be kept out of this chamber by thugs, mobs, or threats. We will not bow to lawlessness or intimidation. We are back at our posts. We will discharge our duty under the Constitution and for our nation. And we're going to do it tonight. This afternoon, Congress began the process of honoring the will of the American people and counting the Electoral College votes. We've fulfilled this solemn duty every 4 years for more than two centuries. Whether our nation's been at war or at peace, under all manner of threats, even during an ongoing armed rebellion and the Civil War, the clockwork of our democracy has carried on. The United States and the United States Congress have faced down much greater threats than the unhinged crowd we saw today. We've never been deterred before, and will be not deterred today. They tried to disrupt our democracy. They failed. They failed. They failed to attempt to obstruct the Congress. This failed insurrection only underscores how crucial the task before us is for our republic. Our nation was founded precisely so that the free choice of the American people is what shapes our self-government and determines the destiny of our nation. Not fear, not force, but the peaceful expression of the popular will. Now, we assemble this afternoon to count our citizens' votes and to formalize their choice of the next president. Now we're going to finish exactly what we started. We'll complete the process the right way, by the book. We'll follow our precedents, our laws, and our Constitution to the letter. And we will certify the winner of the 2020 presidential election. Criminal behavior will never dominate the United States Congress. This institution is resilient. Our democratic republic is strong. The American people deserve nothing less.
Mitch McConnell, Majority Leader of the Senate.
Democratic Leader.
Now Chuck Schumer, the Minority Leader.
Mr. President, it is very, very difficult to put into words what has transpired today. I have never lived through or even imagined an experience like the one we have just witnessed in this Capitol. President Franklin Roosevelt set aside December 7, 1941, as a day that will live in infamy. Unfortunately, we can now add January 6, 2021, to that very short list of dates in American history that will live forever in infamy. This temple to democracy was desecrated, its windows smashed, our offices vandalized. The world saw Americans' elected officials hurriedly ushered out because they were in harm's way. The House and Senate floors were places of shelter until the evacuation was ordered, leaving rioters to stalk these hallowed halls. Lawmakers and our staffs, average citizens who love their country, serve it every day, feared for their lives. I understand that one woman was shot and tragically lost her life. We mourn her and feel for her friends and family. These images were projected to the world. Foreign embassies cabled home their home capitals to report the harrowing scenes at the very heart of our democracy. This will be a stain on our country, not so easily washed away. The final, terrible, indelible legacy of the 45th President of the United States, undoubtedly our worst. I want to be very clear. Those who perform these reprehensible acts cannot be called protesters. No, these were rioters and insurrectionists, goons and thugs, domestic terrorists. They do not represent America. They were a few thousand violent extremists who tried to take over the Capitol building and attack our democracy. They must and should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, hopefully by this administration, if not, certainly by the next. They should be provided no leniency. I want to thank the many of the Capitol Hill Police and Secret Service and local police who kept us safe today and worked to clear the Capitol and return it to its rightful owners and its rightful purpose. I want to thank the leaders, Democrat and Republican, House and Senate. It was Speaker Pelosi, Leader McConnell, Leader McCarthy, and myself who came together and decided that these thugs would not succeed, that we would finish the work of our Constitution requires us to complete. In the very legislative chambers of the House and Senate that were desecrated, but we know always belong to the people, and do again tonight. But make no mistake, my friends, today's events did not happen spontaneously. The president who promoted conspiracy theories that motivated these thugs, the president who exhorted them to come to our nation's capital, egg them on, he hardly ever discourages violence and more often encourages it. This president bears a great deal of the blame. This mob was in good part President Trump's doing, incited by his words, his lies. This violence, in good part, his responsibility, his everlasting shame. Today's events certainly would not have happened without him. Now, January 6th will go down as one of the darkest days in recent American history. A final warning to our nation about the consequences of a demagogic president. The people who enable him, the captive media that parrots his lies, and the people who follow him as he attempts to push America to the brink of ruin. As we reconvene tonight, let us remember, in the end, all this mob has really accomplished is to delay our work by a few hours. We'll resume our responsibilities now, and we will finish our task tonight. The House and Senate chambers will be restored good as new and ready for legislating in short order. The counting of the electoral votes is our sacred duty. Democracy's roots in this nation are deep, they're strong, and they will not be undone, ever, by a group of thugs. Democracy will triumph, as it has for centuries. So to my fellow Americans, who who are shocked and appalled by the images on their televisions today, and who are worried about the future of this country, let me speak to you directly. The divisions in our country clearly run deep, but we are a resilient, forward-looking, and optimistic people, and we will begin the hard work of repairing this nation tonight, because here in America, we do hard things. In America, we always overcome our challenges. Yield the floor.
Chuck Schumer, the Democrat leader, who spoke after Republican leader, the outgoing Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who said that the Senate will not be intimidated, that he will and his colleagues will not be kept out of the chamber by thugs, mobs, or threats, and he vowed that the Senate will finish exactly what it started earlier today, by the book, with the counting of electoral votes. CBS's Margaret Brennan, who is the moderator of Face the Nation, has reporting tonight that suggests that the talk in Washington around the idea of the 25th Amendment and potentially taking the president's powers away is actually something that's getting serious discussion. Margaret, thanks for joining us. Tell us what you know.
Thanks, Stephen. This is obviously something that has massive consequences and huge gravity. So the reporting is not something that we're doing and taking lightly. But there are whispers among cabinet members about potentially invoking the 25th Amendment, which would effectively end Donald Trump's presidency early, just a matter of 2 weeks early, but would remove him from office. We know that this is being whispered about by cabinet members. My reporting is that it has not been formally presented in a way that would trigger any kind of procedure to actually begin. But this has moved beyond simple speculation among political watchers, and it has reached the highest levels of the U.S. government.
And just to recapitulate for folks who are listening who may have a vague understanding of the 25th Amendment, what it essentially says is that the cabinet secretaries, in conjunction with the vice president, can sign a document and transmit it to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, who is the vice president, and essentially say that they have determined that the president is no longer capable of performing his duties, and therefore the power of acting president or president would transfer to the vice president. So this is something that right now, Margaret Brennan, your reporting, has been discussed among cabinet members.
Yes. As to pinning down where each cabinet member stands, that's a matter for us to continue to report out. But this is not just a matter of political watchers speculating at this point. It doesn't mean it will happen. It means that it's being discussed as a concept, and we will be watching this very carefully. Of course, this would effectively make the vice president, who today was there in the Capitol when pro-Trump supporters stormed it, and was put in harm's way, commander-in-chief for this limited period of time before Joe Biden, the president-elect, is formally sworn in on Inauguration Day, January the 20th. But keep in mind, this is a limited amount of time. The Trump presidency is scheduled to remain in office. However, the events of today have so snowballed and taken so many by surprise in terms of the gravity and the images projected around the world, that it has changing in thinking among some within the cabinet. But as to where this goes, this could peter out. This could amount to nothing. But the discussion is happening among some members of them.
All right, Margaret Brennan, we'll let you go. More reporting to do tonight. Margaret Brennan, moderator of Face the Nation, for joining us. Vice President Pence, as he convened the evening session at just after 8 o'clock Eastern Time, said that the people's work continues in the Senate. He says that, quote, we condemn the violence in the strongest possible terms. And he had a message for those who, in his words, wreaked havoc in our Capitol today. He said, you did not win. Freedom wins. This is still the people's house. And he said the fact that the people's representatives are reconvening on the very same day that the Capitol was overtaken by a mob of violent demonstrators and protesters, marauders, if you will, is an emblem of the fact that America and its democracy is resilient. Let's go back to the Senate floor, where members of both parties are now speaking.
starting with the fundamental American principle in our Declaration of Independence, that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. The people have spoken in this election, and our only job here today is to do what they ask. It is not to argue election security. That's not the place for what we are doing today. Our Constitution specifically reserves to the people the right to meet in their respective states and vote for the president and vice president. As a result, individual states oversee and implement the election process, not the federal government. To guard against fraud or irregularities in the voting process, the states are required to have robust election security measures. Likewise, state legislatures have the opportunity to examine evidence of voter fraud before they certified their electoral college votes. And our courts, from district courts to the United States Supreme Court, adjudicate legal challenges and election disputes. All of those things happened after the 2020 election. State houses and courts across the country took allegations of voter fraud seriously and followed the constitutional process to hear challenges to this year's elections. No state found evidence of any widespread voter fraud, and neither did any court ask to review the state's findings. In Arizona, Republican Governor Doug Ducey, Democratic Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, Republican Attorney General Mark Brnovich, and State Supreme Court Chief Justice Robert Brutenow all certified the results of the election on November 30th. And we know, we have heard, Arizonans have been voting by mail for almost 30 years, and Governor Ducey has expressed confidence in the state's process numerous times. In November, he said, "We do elections well here in Arizona. The system is strong, and that's why I have bragged on it so much." He further stated, "We have some of the strongest election laws in the country, laws that prioritize accountability and clearly lay out our procedures for canvassing and even contesting the results." And they are right. Arizona has one of the most transparent election processes in the country, with built-in accountability, starting with internal auditing. We have heard unfounded allegations that voting machines in Arizona and elsewhere somehow changed vote tallies or somehow improperly rejected ballots while claiming to accept them. These allegations all ignore the fact that Arizona counties conducted ballot audits by hand to double-check the machine counts, and these audits found no widespread fraud or irregularities. Maricopa County, the county where more than 60% of the state population resides, conducted a post-election hand count audit in the week after the election, which showed perfect 100% accuracy in the machine tabulations. So why would we need, my colleagues, to call for a 10-day emergency audit to be conducted by a legislative commission when it's already been done by the state of Arizona? What happened to states' rights? The audit involved checking ballots for the presidential election, but also ballots for federal and state legislative elections. The audit report shows every precinct's machine and hand count totals for each of the races audited. And for every single race in every precinct, the difference between the hand count and the machine count was zero. Maricopa's audit report stated, "No discrepancies were found by the hand count audit boards." Seeking to find any reason to contest these results, some of the state Republicans then tried to claim that Maricopa County failed to follow state law in conducting this audit by selecting voting center locations to audit instead of voting precincts. This was wrong. And this, too, went to a court. In rejecting this claim, state court in Arizona found that the county followed the properly issued guidance on hand audit procedures from the Arizona Secretary of State. And the court found that Maricopa County officials, therefore, could not lawfully have performed the hand count audit the way the plaintiffs wanted it done. If they had done so, they would have exposed themselves to criminal punishment.
The senator's 5 minutes is expired.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President. I would close by just saying, Please, my colleagues, do not disenfranchise the voters of Arizona and certify their votes tonight. Thank you.
Majority Leader.
Mr. President, I yield up to 5 minutes to the Senator from Utah, Senator Lee.
Senator from Utah.
Mike Lee, Republican of Utah.
At the time I prepared my remarks for today, it seems like a lifetime ago. A lot's changed in the last few hours. And so I'm going to deliver some of the same remarks, but it has a little bit of a different feel than it would have just a few hours ago. My thoughts and prayers go out to the family members of those who have been injured or killed today. My heartfelt gratitude goes out to the Capitol Hill Police, who valiantly defended our building and our lives. Well, it's true that legitimate concerns have been raised with regard to how some of the key battleground states conducted their presidential elections. This is not the end of the story. We each have to remember that we've sworn an oath to uphold, protect, and defend this document, written nearly 2.5 centuries ago by wise men raised up by God to that very purpose. That document makes clear what our role is and what it isn't. It makes clear who does what when it comes to deciding presidential elections. You see, because in our system of government, presidents are not directly elected. They're chosen by preferential electors. And the Constitution makes very clear, under Article 2, Section 1, that the states shall appoint presidential electors according to procedures that their legislatures develop. Then comes the 12th Amendment. It explains what we're doing here today in the Capitol. It explains that the President of the Senate, the Vice President of the United States, shall open the ballots, and the votes shall then be counted. It's those words that confine, define, and constrain every scrap of authority we have in this process. Our job is to open and then count. Open, then count. That's it. That's all there is. Now, there are, of course, rare instances in which multiple slates of electors can be submitted by the same state. That doesn't happen very often. It happened in 1960, it happened in 1876. Let's hope it doesn't ever happen again. In those rare moments, Congress has to make a choice. It has to decide which of the electoral votes will be counted and which will not. That did not happen here. Thank heavens, and let's hope that it never does. Now, many of my colleagues have raised objections or had previously stated their intent to raise objections with regard to these. I've spent an enormous time on this last few weeks. I've met with lawyers on both sides of the issue. I've met with lawyers representing the Trump campaign, reading everything I could find about the constitutional provisions in question. And I've spent a lot of time on the phone with legislators and other leaders from the contested states. I didn't initially declare my position because I didn't yet have one. I wanted to get the facts first, and I wanted to understand what was happening. I wanted to give the people serving in government in the contested states the opportunity to do whatever they felt they needed to do to make sure that their election was properly reflected. I spent an enormous amount of time reaching out to state government officials in those states, but in none of the contested states, no, not even one, did I discover any indication that there was any chance that any state legislature or secretary of state or governor or lieutenant governor had any intention to alter the slate of electors. That being the case, our job is a very simple one. This simply isn't how our federal system is supposed to work. That is to say, if you have concerns with the way that an election in the presidential race was handled in your state, the appropriate response is to approach your state legislatures, first and foremost. These protests, from hearing from those who have raised concerns, they should have been focused on their state capitals, not their nation's capital. Because our role is narrow. Our role is defined. Our role is limited. Yes, we are the election judges when it comes to members elected to our own body. And yes, the House of Representatives, they're the judges of their own races there. We also have the authority to prescribe, as a Congress, rules governing the time, place, and manner of elections for senators and representatives. There is no corresponding authority with respect to presidential elections. None whatsoever. It doesn't exist. Our job is to convene, to open the ballots, and to count them. Thank you, Mr. President. I yield the floor.
Democratic leader.
Colorado, Mr. Bennett.
Senator from Colorado.
Thank you, Mr. Vice President.
Michael Bennett, Democrat, Colorado.
President, colleagues, it's been a terrible day for everybody here and for our country. One of the things I was thinking about today is something I often think about when I'm on this floor, which is that the founders of this country, the people that wrote our Constitution, actually knew our history better than we know our history. And I was thinking about that history today as we saw the mob riot in Washington, D.C., thinking about what the founders were thinking about when they wrote our Constitution, which was what happened to the Roman Republic when armed gangs doing the work for politicians prevented Rome from casting their ballots for consuls, for praetors, for senators. These were the offices in Rome. And these armed gangs ran through the streets of Rome, keeping elections from being started, elections from ever being called. And in the end, because of that, the Roman Republic fell and a dictator took its place. And that was the end of the Roman Republic, or any republic for that matter, until this beautiful Constitution was written in the United States of America. So it is my fervent hope that the way that we respond to this today, my dear colleague, is that we give the biggest bipartisan vote we can in support of our democracy and in support of our Constitution and in rejection for what we saw today and what the Roman Republic saw in its own time. There's a tendency around this place, I think, to always believe that we're the first people to confront something when that's seldom the case, and to underappreciate what the effect of our actions will be. We need to deeply appreciate in this moment our obligation to the Constitution, our obligation to the democracy, our obligation to the Republic. There are people in this chamber that have twisted the words of a statute written in the 19th century that was meant to actually settle our electoral disputes, to leave them with the states, as the senator from Utah was saying, to give us a ministerial role, except in very rare circumstances. That's what that law is about, that the senator of Texas was talking about today. And that's the law that's leading us to be asked to overturn the judgments of 60 courts in America, many of the courts in Arizona, some of whom have howled the president's lawyers out of the courtrooms because there's no evidence of fraud. And by the way, the fact that 37% or 39% of Americans think there's no evidence of fraud, or they think there's evidence of fraud, does not is fraud. If you turned a blind eye to a conspiracy theory, you can't now come to the floor of the Senate and say you're ignoring the people who believe the election was stolen. Go out there and tell them the truth, which is that every single member of this Senate knows this election wasn't stolen. And that we, just as in the Roman Republic, have a responsibility to protect the independence of the judiciary from politicians who will stop at nothing to hold on to power. There's nothing new about that either. That's been true since the First Republic was founded. So now we find ourselves in a position just days after many senators here swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. Every single member of the House of Representatives swore the same oath as well. And I think we've got a solemn obligation and responsibility here to prove once again that this country is a nation of and not of men. And the only result that we can reach together is one that rejects the claim of the senator from Texas and the other members of the House and Senate to overturn the decisions that are made by the states, by the voters in the states, and by the courts. If we follow what they have proposed, we will be the ones that will have disenfranchised every single person who cast a vote in this election, whether they voted for the president or they didn't. I urge you to reject this, and I deeply appreciate the opportunity to serve with every single one of you. Thank you, Mr. President.
Michael Bennett, Democrat, Colorado.
Majority Leader.
I yield up to 5 minutes to the Senator from Georgia, Senator Loeffler.
Kelly Loeffler, Republican of Georgia.
Mr. President, when I arrived in Washington this morning, I fully intended to object to the certification of electoral votes. However, the events that have transpired today have forced me to reconsider, and I cannot now in good conscience object to the certification of these electors. The violence, the lawlessness, and siege of the halls of Congress are abhorrent and stand as a direct attack on the very institution my objection was intended to protect, the sanctity of the American democratic process. And I thank law enforcement for keeping us safe. I believe that there were last-minute changes to the November 2020 election process and serious irregularities that resulted in too many Americans losing confidence not only in the integrity of our elections, but in the power of the ballot as a tool of democracy. Too many Americans frustrated at what they see as an unfair system. Nevertheless, there is no excuse for the events that took place in these chambers today, and I pray that America never suffers such a dark day again. Though the fate of this vote is clear, the future of the American people's faith in the core institution of this democracy remains uncertain. We as a body must turn our focus to protecting the integrity of our elections and restoring every American's faith that their voice and their vote matters. America is a divided country with serious differences, but it is still the greatest country on earth. There can be no disagreement that upholding democracy is the only path to preserving our republic. I yield the floor.
Senator Kelly Loeffler, defeated last night in a runoff election in Georgia, says she will no longer object to the counting of electoral votes from the states.
And it's to Senator Booker and 2.5 minutes to Senator Kaine.
First up, Cory Booker, Democrat, New Jersey.
Mr. President, my colleague,
Senator from Virginia.
Senator Kaine.
I applaud the comments of my colleague from Georgia deeply. My first job after school was in Macon, Georgia, working for a federal judge, Lanier Anderson. And I learned a lot about integrity and a lot about law from him. I also learned some sad lessons. That in the history of Georgia, and indeed Virginia and many states, so many people, especially people of color, have been disenfranchised over the course of our history. Our late friend, John Lewis, congressman from Georgia, was savagely beaten on Bloody Sunday just for marching for voting rights. That act of violence inspired this body, the U.S. Senate, to come together in March of 1965 and work to pass in a bipartisan fashion the Voting Rights Act. We should be coming together today after acts of violence as a United States Senate to affirm the votes of all who cast ballots in November. Instead, we're unprecedented objection that would be a massive disenfranchisement of American voters. The Georgia result was very clear, a 12,000 vote margin, two certifications by Republican officials, four separate recounts and canvasses, seven lawsuits, as in the other states. If we object to results like this, the message is so clear. We are saying to states, no matter how secure and accurate your elections are, we'll gladly overthrow them if we don't like who you voted for. But more importantly, what we'll be saying, really what we'll be doing, is as the body that acted together to guarantee Americans the right to vote, we will become the agent of one of the most massive disenfranchisements in the history of this country. So I urge all of my colleagues, please oppose these objections. Thank you, and I yield to my colleague from New Jersey.
From New Jersey.
Thanks. Mr. Vice President, I can only think of two times in American history that individuals laid siege to our Capitol, stormed our sacred civic spaces, and tried to upend and overrun this government. One was in the War of 1812, and the other one was today. What's interesting about the parallel between the two is they both were waving flags to a sole sovereign, to an individual, surrendering democratic principles to the cult of personality. One was a monarch in England, and the other were the flags I saw all over our Capitol, including in the hallways and in this room, to a single person named Donald Trump. The sad difference between these two times is one was yet another nation in the history of our country that tried to challenge the United States of America. But this time, we brought this hell upon ourselves. My colleague from Texas said that this was a moment where there were unprecedented allegations of voter fraud. Yes, that is true. They were unprecedented when the president, before the election even happened, said, if I lose this election, then the election was rigged. That's unprecedented. It's unprecedented before the night of the voting, even the counting of the vote was even done, that he called it rigged. And it's unprecedented that he is fanning flames of conspiracy theory to create a smokescreen in this nation to cover what he is trying to do, which is undermine our democratic principles. But it's not shame of this day, is it's being aided and abetted by good Americans who are falling prey, who are choosing Trump over truth, who are surrendering to the passion as opposed to standing up, speaking truth to power, who are trying to fundraise off of the shame of conspiracy theories as opposed to doing the incalculably valuable, patriotic thing to speak truth to our nation. Our democracy is wounded, and I saw it when I saw pictures of yet another insurgency, of a flag of another group of Americans who tried to challenge our nation. I saw the flag of the Confederacy there. What will we do? How will we confront this shame? How will we confront this dark second time in American history? I pray that we remember a Georgian. In his words, all I can say is we must in spirit join together like those Georgians on a bridge called the Edmund Pettus, who joined hands, who were called threats to our democracy, who were called outrageous epithets when they sought to expand our democracy, to save it and to heal it, when they joined arm in arm and said what we should say now, commit ourselves to that ideal, that together we shall overcome.
New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker.
You elected 5 minutes. The senator from Nebraska, Senator Sass.
Senator from Nebraska.
Nebraska Senator Ben Sass.
And Mr. Vice President, let me just say before I begin, thank you for the way you have fulfilled your constitutional duties and your oath of office today. It obviously hasn't been easy. Colleagues, today has been ugly. And when I came to the floor this morning, I planned to talk about the lesson of 1801, because I'm kind of a history nerd, and I wanted to celebrate the glories of the peaceful transition of power across our nation's history. Feels a little naive now to talk about ways that American civics might be something that could unite us in bringing us back together. 1801 blew everybody's mind all over the world, by the way. John Adams loses to Thomas Jefferson, and Adams willingly leaves the executive mansion and moves back to Massachusetts, and Jefferson peacefully assumes power, and people all over Europe said, that must be fake news. Those must be bad reports. There's no way any executive would ever willingly lay down power. And yet Adams, in defeat, did something glorious to give all of us a gift. I wanted to celebrate that, and it feels a little bit harder now. This building has been desecrated. Blood has been spilled in the hallways. I was with octogenarian members of this chamber that needed to have troops and police stabilize them to get down the stairs at a time when a lot of our staffs were panicked and under their desks and not knowing what was going to happen to them. It was ugly today. But you know what? It turns out that when something's ugly, talking about beauty isn't just permissible. Talking about beauty is obligatory in a time like that. Why? Why would we talk about beauty after the ugliness of today? Because our kids need to know that this isn't what America is. What happened today isn't what America is. They've been given a glorious inheritance. This is the 59th presidential election. If the vice president wasn't the chair and if the president pro tem was, I'd have made some joke that Chuck Grassley has voted in two-thirds of those 59 presidential elections. He's laughing. It's not as good as hit deer, deer dead, but it's still got a Grassley laugh. I don't think we want to tell the Americans that come after us that this republic is broken, that this is just a banana republic, that our institutions can't be trusted. I don't think we want that. We don't want that in this body. We don't want that in our hometowns. I don't think we want to tell our kids that America's best days are behind us, because it's not true. That's not who we are. America isn't Hatfields and McCoys blood feud forever. America's a union. There's a lot that's broken in this country, but not anything that's so big that the American people can't rebuild it, that freedom and community and entrepreneurial effort and that neighborhoods can't rebuild. Nothing that's broken is so big that we can't fix it. Generations of our forefathers and our foremothers, probably not a word, our ancestors, have spilled blood to defend the glories of this republic. Why would they do that? Because America is the most exceptional nation in the history of the world, and because the Constitution is the greatest political document that's ever been written. Most governments in the past have said might makes right, and we saw some of that Thuligan nuttery today. Might makes right. No, it doesn't. God gives us rights by nature, and government is just our shared project to secure those rights. America has always been about what we choose to do together, the way we reaffirm our constitutional system, where we've got some governmental tasks, and we all in this body could do better at those governmental tasks, but the heart of America is not government. The center of America is not Washington, D.C. The center of America is the neighborhoods where 330 million Americans are raising their kids and trying to put food on the table and trying to love their neighbor. That's the center of America. We're not supposed to be the most important people in America. We're supposed to be servant leaders who try to maintain a framework for ordered liberty so that there's a structure that back home where they live, they can get from the silver frame of structure and order to the golden apple at the center, as Washington would have said it, which is the things that they build together. The places where they coach Little League, where they invite people to synagogue or church. Sometimes the big things we do together are governmental, like kicking Hitler's ass or like going to the moon. Sometimes there is governmental stuff, but the heart of America is about places where moms and dads are raising kids, and we're supposed to serve them by maintaining order and by rejecting violence. You can't do big things like that if you hate your neighbors. You can't do big things together as Americans if you think other Americans are the enemy. Look, there's a lot of uncertainty about the future. I get it. And there's a lot that does need to be rebuilt. But if you're angry, I want to beg you, don't let the screamers who monetize hate have the final word. Don't let nihilists become your drug dealers. There are some who want to burn it all down. We met some of them today, but they aren't going to win. Don't let them be your prophets. Instead, organize, persuade, but most importantly, love your neighbor. Visit the widower down the street who's lonely, no one tell anybody that his wife died. He didn't. And shovel somebody's neighbor, or shovel somebody's driveway. You can't hate somebody who just shoveled your driveway. The heart of life is about community and neighborhood, and we're supposed to be servant leaders. The constitutional system is still the greatest order for any government ever, and it's our job to steward it and protect it. Let's remember that today when we vote.
Ben Sass, Republican in Nebraska.
Senator Durbin.
Senator from Illinois.
Dick Durbin, Illinois Democrat.
March of 1861, a Springfield lawyer caught a train to Washington. His name was Abraham Lincoln. It wasn't his first trip here. He'd served as a congressman 15 years before, and he returned in the beginning of the Civil War to serve as president. It was a different place than he knew it as congressman, and 15 years had changed a lot. The Spriggs boarding house across the street, which is now the Library of Congress, was gone. And this building was changing. Big changes. They're building a dome on the Capitol. But they were also in the earliest days of a war, and President Lincoln was counseled, stop building the dome. It costs too much money, and we can't spend any more time on it. And he said, no, we're going to build that dome, and we're going to finish it. That dome and this building will be a symbol of this country that will survive this Civil War and come back strong. So they built the dome, they won the war, and since those days, that dome and this building have been a symbol to this country, a symbol of unity and of hope. Tourists come through here before COVID-19 by the tens of thousands, and if you've ever noticed their tours, they're often shushed. People are saying, show some respect for this building. We know this building in the Rotunda as a place where some of the greatest American heroes of both political parties lie in state, and we go there to honor them. We know this building because we work here. We enact laws here that change America. We gather for State of the Union messages from presidents and honor the people in the gallery. Special place. This is a sacred place. But this sacred place was desecrated by a mob today on our watch. This temple to democracy was defiled by thugs who roamed the halls and sat in that chair, Mr. Vice President, the one that you vacated at 2:15 this afternoon, sat and posed for pictures, those who were roaming around this chamber. What brought this on? Did this mob spring spontaneously from America? No. This mob was invited to come to Washington on this day by this president for one reason. Because he knew the Electoral College vote was going to be counted this day. He wanted this mob to disrupt the constitutional process which we are part of. This mob was inspired by a president who cannot accept defeat. If you wonder whether I'm going too far in what I say, just read the transcript with the Secretary of State from Georgia and listen to this president's wild conspiracy theories, one after the other, swatted down by that Republican elected official and his attorney as having no basis in fact. This president begs. He coaxes, he even threatens that Secretary of State to find the votes he needs. In any other venue, that would be a simple, obvious crime. The lengths he will go to are obvious. The Texas senator says to us, well, many people still agree with him, you know, when it gets down to the bottom line. Many people have fallen for this presidential position that it must have been a rigged election if I lost. Well, I would say that after we've lost count, 57 lawsuits, 62 lawsuits, I've heard so many numbers, after 90 different judges, after this president took his case, the best he could put together, to the highest court in the land across the street, where he has personally chosen three justices on the court, I say to the senator from Texas, you know much more about that court than I do. I don't believe they let that paper that he sent up there even hit the desk before they laughed it out of the court. And that's the best he had to offer. No evidence whatsoever of this rigged election and this fraudulence. The senator from Texas says, we just want to create a little commission. 10 days, we're going to audit all the states, particularly the ones in contention here, and find out what actually occurred. And it really draws its parallel in 1876, Hayes and Tilden. Don't forget what that commission, that so-called political compromise, achieved. It was not just some ordinary governmental commission. It was a commission that came to action, that established Jim Crow, that even after a civil war which tore this nation apart, it re-enslaved African Americans, and it was a commission that invited the voter suppression we are still fighting today in America. Let me close by saying this. The vote we're going to have here is a clear choice of whether we are going to feed the beast of ignorance or we are going to tell the truth to the American people. We saw that beast today roaming the halls. Let's not invite it back.
Majority Leader.
I yield up to 5 minutes to the Senator from Kansas, Senator Marshall.
Senator from Kansas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Freedom of speech and the freedom to protest are provided in our Constitution. And while I share the same frustrations many Americans have over the presidential election, the violence and mob rule which occurred at the U.S. Capitol today and across the country over the past year are unacceptable, and I condemn them at the highest level. And like all of us in the chamber, I'm thankful for the heroic law enforcement officers who worked feverishly to restore order so we get back to the electoral certification process. During my 29-year career as an obstetrician and gynecologist, too often I had to sit down with patients and give them a very bad diagnosis. It might have been a young mother of three who I delivered all three of her babies now with metastatic breast cancer, or perhaps another woman with advanced cervical or ovarian cancer, all with a very challenging prognosis. But before I sat down with each one of those patients, I carefully reviewed all their labs, their x-rays and their pathology to make sure I had the facts straight. But at the end of the day, my final recommendation was always going to be a recommendation from my heart. I want my fellow Kansans and all Americans to know that I've given as much consideration and thought surrounding the issue objecting to a state's electoral college votes as I did considering the treatment plan for a serious health concern. And today's decision, once again, is from my heart. Mr. President, I rise today for integrity to our republic. And I rise to join the many of our colleagues who are all concerned for current and future generations. We must restore faith and confidence in one of our republic's most hallowed patriotic duties, voting. There is no question our U.S. Constitution empowers state legislatures to execute free, legal, and fair elections. Unfortunately, in several states, the clear authority of those state legislatures to determine the rules for voting were usurped by governors, secretaries of states, and activist courts. Our laws and Constitution should always be followed, especially in a time of crisis. I don't rise and do a state's legally obtained electoral college votes. Rather, I rise in hopes of improving the integrity of the ballot to hold states accountable to the time-proven constitutional system of the electoral college. This is why I urge the formation of an electoral commission to give constructive suggestions and recommendations that states can make to make our elections once again safe, free, and fair after a year of jarring irregularities. We must and will have a peaceful transition to power. To all my fellow Americans, I have no doubt that our republic can go stronger through this difficult day. May God bless this great republic.
Senator Roger Marshall there of Kansas.